During the course of this morning at approximately the midday hours, we observed a light aircraft, a light biplane, coming in from the would be the north. Its line of flight was approximately over the Manly Ferry Wharf, flew straight down the harbour, and ultimately went back out to sea, possibly in the Kurnell region. All the time the aircraft was in flight at approximately 3,000 feet above the harbour, it was being observed by all the anti-aircraft batteries, fortresses in the area. I was in the observation post at North Head, and the orders, as I heard them coming through, were that no guns were to fire on this aircraft because it was considered that it was up there for the purpose of observing gun flashes.
May 1942. Sergeant Freddie Dwyer of Newcastle was in Sydney on an officer's training course.
3 days later, on the Sunday morning, I left North Head to partake of leave in Newcastle. I joined one of the early morning ferries across to Circular Quay, and I was subsequently told that in our convoy through the deep channel port through the boom gates, we followed a hospital ship, closely followed by the three midget submarines and the Manly Ferry. The story then resumes that that night I caught the quarter to eight train from Broadmeadow back to Sydney, joined the Sydney Ferry to Manly, and round about Garden Island we heard gunshots, ricochets, a blackening out of Sydney and vessels all around. And as we come closer to the Chicago, the American cruiser, we could even observe the ricochets, which I thought was a darn fool thing for an American battleship to be firing live ammunition in the middle of a busy harbour. Past the Chicago, the ship was subjected to depth charge, the thumps, from them, from the little auxiliary coast patrol boats. And we didn't know any more till we got to Manly and disembarked. And of course Manly was in an uproar. Military police and people running around all over with bedding over their shoulders. And well, we were raced then back by military police back to the fort, and then that's when we were told that the area had been under attack. This shelling and the bombardment of the harbour, I consider, was the awakening to the Australian people of the fact that war was really on their doorstep.
We present War on the Doorstep, a documentary account of World War II Japanese naval action leading to the shelling of Newcastle on the 8th of June 1942.
War first came to southeastern Australia when the Japanese submarine I-29 shelled the steamship Wellen, some 30 miles from Newcastle, on the 16th of May 1942. The 2,500-ton I-29 under Captain Katsuta was one of a fleet of five large ocean-going submarines from the Japanese 8th Squadron, cruising off the New South Wales coast. Three of the submarines carried midget subs clamped to their decks. The I-29 and I-21 carried float planes. On the 23rd of May, the I-29 launched her aircraft for a reconnaissance of Sydney Harbour. And on the 30th, Second Lieutenant Suzumo Ito and an observer took the I-21's float plane at less than 600 feet over Garden Island and Farm Cove. They flew so low over Cockatoo Island that they could see the welding torches of workers at the dockyard. Back at sea, the aircraft made a safe landing but overturned in the heavy swell. Ito and his observer swam safely to the submarine. The 31st of May saw the three midget submarines inside Sydney Harbour. After missing the cruiser USS Chicago and torpedoing the HMAS Cuttable, killing some 21 sailors, they too were sent to the bottom. They carried with them charts and photos of targets such as Garden Island, the Hawkesbury River Railway Bridge, and in Newcastle, the Broken Hill Proprietary Limited, the floating dock, and the Walsh Island shipyards, although the shipyards had been closed for 10 years. On the 3rd of June 1942, the 5,000-ton cargo vessel Iron Chieftain sailed from Newcastle. At 10:30 in the evening, about 30 miles off the coast, she too was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine, either the I-21 or the I-24. Sid Verity was a fireman on the stricken ship.
Just before it happened, we were lying in our bunks. We heard the alarm go off. No one wanted to be the first up, and we all sat and looked at each other. And must have been about 10 seconds later, the torpedo hit. We were all knocked out of our bunks then. Went up on deck. Went along the stokehold to see how my mates were. Couldn't hear anything from down there. I knew they were gone. Went down below to get the life jacket, and I stood up on deck for a while to see how fast she was settling. Then I went down below to get the life jacket and overcoat. And when I got up on deck, it was just time to get off the boat, get off the ship into the lifeboat. I didn't see the captain. His quarters were midships and ours were down aft. As one AB tried to get the life raft off the rigging, and he stood in front of it instead of to one side, and he got his head split in halves doing that. And when I got into the lifeboat, the chief engineer tried to jump in after me, and he got caught in between the lifeboat and the ship and got cut in halves. That was all the action I saw on deck. It was pretty rough weather, and all the rollocks on the lifeboat had been cut. The plug wasn't in the hole. We held a sock in the hole, took it in turns because the water was pretty cold. We were rowing around, trying to row around with one chap holding the oars, the other bloke rowing, until we found the rollocks that were left in the bottom of the boat. And we rowed around for a couple of hours, picking up other chaps. When we were rowing around picking them up, the second engineer was swimming through the water, and one chap yelled out, "Have you got the overtime book second?" Because he kept all the overtime in this book. And in the meantime, the two submarines was just standing off, a couple of hundred yards away by this time. They were pretty close when they hit the ship. And they started throwing the searchlights on us, and we all thought we were going to be machine gunned. And a plane flew over, and the lights went out, and the subs moved away. Anyway, we've managed to find the rollocks. They were in the bottom of the boat. We put them back in. We were pulling away in the lifeboat, and I was watching. I've never felt so lonely in all my life. Just see the mast go underwater, the last part of the ship to go under. And just nothing left. Just us in the lifeboat. We had to wait till sun up to know which way we were going, so we didn't turn around and go back. We headed back towards Terrigal. We didn't know it was Terrigal at the time. We didn't know where we were heading, just as long as we were sure. Oh, we were complaining a bit about not having any provisions. They'd been all stolen. There was no chocolate. The blankets had been taken. The compass had been stolen. All we had was a tin of dog biscuits, and we were just chewing those, and we had some stale water. That's the lot. But no one was panicking or anything. One chap was complaining about his cigarette tobacco, his tobacco not drying out properly. The second night out, we heard this bombura off the shore, and we weren't game to head inland past the bombura. We didn't know which way to go, so we just threw up some flares and sat there for the rest of the night. And in the morning, all the town turned out and formed a human arrow on the beach to guide us in past the bombura. And they took us into various homes and fed us and clothed us ready to go to town.
Sid Verity was one of the lucky ones on the Iron Chieftain. 12 of his crewmates and the captain went to the bottom, entombed in the ship. Japanese submarine activity on the New South Wales coast intensified. On the same day as the Iron Chieftain was sunk, the vessel Age came under gunfire but was undamaged. On the 4th of June, the Barwon escaped an attack, and also on the 4th, the Iron Crown was torpedoed and went down in 1 minute with 37 hands. Along the coast, fixed defence batteries stood guard at the entrances to strategic ports and near major industrial cities such as Newcastle.
At the commencement of World War II, there were two main forts, Fort Scratchley and Fort Wallace. Fort Scratchley was armed with two 6-inch Mark 7 guns, the two which are currently back in place there now. Fort Wallace was in the process of changing from two 6-inch Mark 7s to two 9.2-inch Mark 10. That changeover was completed early in 1940. In addition, there were two sections of two 3-pounder guns, one situated at the foot of Nobby's and the other one on the beach north of Stockton, between North Stockton and Fort Wallace. The control of the whole of the Newcastle Fortress area was carried out from a command post situated on Shepherd's Hill, the remains of which can still be seen on the southern side of King Edward Park.
Colonel Dick Mort. During World War II, he was officer in charge of the battery at Fort Wallace. In June 1942, as the Japanese submarine squadron ravaged the New South Wales coastline, Fortress Newcastle, including gun and searchlight emplacements, was under the overall command of Colonel P.W. Dobson. His battery commander in charge of the detachment and two 6-inch guns at Fort Scratchley was Major Wal Watson.
The actual gun detachment would consist of, thinking of ammunition numbers and people down the casemate and places like that, I suppose the full operating detachment would amount to as many as 27 people, although not every one of the 27 would be actively doing something all the time. According to their role, they would maybe engage for a matter of minutes, even seconds in some circumstances, whilst, of course, others were busily active all the time. The number one of the gun, for instance, and the autosight layer, the line layer, the loading numbers, they're really busy the whole time. But there are others whose role in the thing, whilst however vital it is, doesn't call for as much activity as you'd find in those particular people. But in effect, you could say that up to 27 men were, in one degree or another, involved in those guns being fired, and fired at the right time and hopefully in the right direction.
There's 13 in the crew. That was your NCO in charge of your gun layers, and your ammunition detail. There's 13 all total.
This is Bombardier Ted Prichter. He was on the ammunition detail on number 2 gun at Fort Scratchley.
Well, your number 1 took the orders from the observation post, which came over loudspeakers. Number 2 was on the breech, and he worked the breech mechanism. Now, I'm a little bit hazy about this. 3 and 5, if I remember rightly, were on the rammer. 4 and 6 were shells, loading the shells, and 7 and 9 loaded the cartridges. That's as far as I can remember. It's a long way back, but still. And then there was the other men down below. There was on the gun, there was your 2 layers, layer for line and layer for elevation. And there was 2 setters behind them, put the corrections on. And then there was 6 men down the shell store and the cartridge store that brought the cartridges and shells back up on the guns to implement what was already on the gun. The shells were a 6-inch shell, and they weighed from 98 to 102 pound. We averaged them out at 100 pound. Now behind that you had 22 pound of cord on, and a little tube, electric tube or a percussion tube for percussion firing, or the electric chair for electric firing, where you had a pistol grip on the gun and it was fired by one of the layers.
The 6-inch guns at Fort Scratchley stand high above the sea. They command a panoramic view of the harbour entrance, Stockton Bight and the ocean to the horizon. The guns form what is known as a close defence battery.
The battery commander in charge of a close defence battery is the ultimate authority as to whether or not he shall engage a vessel, or whether he shall go into action. He doesn't have to ask permission from anybody. The term close defence means that the gun is engaged in poor weather conditions, such as fog, heavy rain, or at night when visibility is only by means of searchlight, and he hasn't time to start asking people whether it's okay for him to fire the guns and so forth. Therefore, by virtue of standing orders, He is charged with the responsibility of making the decision and going into action or otherwise off his own bat, and he accepts full responsibility in either case, whether he should have or if there were circumstances where he'd made an error and he shouldn't have done so. He's got to accept the full responsibility for it.
Major Watson, the larger 9.2-inch guns at Fort Wallace are located just above sea level on the Stockton Peninsula. Unlike Fort Scratchley, they're designed for a counter-bombardment role, the shelling of targets at long range. Colonel Dick Mort.
The 9.2 was a gun that fired a 380-pound shell at to 30,000 yards or some 17 miles. The charge of cordite behind it to push it that distance was 109 pounds. And the gun was elevated to 35 degrees to give it that range.
So in 1942, Fortress Newcastle consisted of two major gun emplacements, the 6-inch guns at Fort Scratchley and the two big 9.2-inch guns at Fort Wallace, along with smaller weapons located immediately at the harbour entrance. In close support were searchlights in various locations. A lieutenant, later Captain Bill Harvey, was searchlight commander.
Fort Scratchley had three lights assigned to it. One was above where the Newcastle baths are, that was known as number one light. The other light was on below the fort, on Nobby's, above Nobby's Road on Fort Drive, and it was number two light, and out there on the Nobby's headland was number three light. Number one light had an arc from as far south without touching the headlands to directly opposite the fort. Number two light went over that and went towards the breakwater, but not touching the breakwater. Number three light, it covered the harbour entrance up towards Stockton Way and down and overlapped on number two light. The lights were all to be HCD lights, high current density, 210 million candle power, and in reserve we had the older lights, the 60 million or LCD low current density lamps. Number one and number two were high current density at that particular time. Number three was out and we had to put a low current density lamp in there. The crew would be two men, a lamp operator and assistant, and there would be one down on the engine room. Each lamp had an engine room attached to it. And they would change at midnight of each night. They would start operating at dusk, go through till midnight. The others would take over, operate from then till dawn. They would sweep constantly, but it would not be a regular sweep. They would go halfway through their zone, come back again, they would vary it, but they would cover the whole zone periodically of their arc.
Day and night for the duration of the war, the guns and the searchlights stood guard over Newcastle's strategic steelworks and dockyards. The defences had another role. They were required to assist in the establishing of credentials of ships wishing to enter port. At that time, it was feared that a captured merchant vessel, with perhaps a prize crew aboard, may attempt to enter the channel leading to the harbour. If such a ship was scuttled, it could block the port for months. All ships arriving at Newcastle, therefore, were challenged by the examination service. The old pilot vessel, Barubi, Southern Cross, was assigned to the task. One of the examination officers on the Barubi was Lieutenant Commander Jack Burgess, Royal Australian Naval Reserve. He challenged ships with coded signals. They were flashed on an Aulis lamp.
They were changed every day. And sometimes it would change twice during the day, sometimes it would not. There were no signals that would have been, had any danger to any shipping. All when, you know, crackpot things are no significance to any shipping, you see. And we'd pass them on and then pass them on to Scratchley. Of course, they had eyes to get them out, and a list of signals come out every week. And if we wanted more than one, we'd, shipping was heavy, we'd alter it. And someone would have tuned the one day.
Lieutenant Commander Burgess would flash an all-clear signal to Fort Scratchley. Only once was a ship stopped with a shot fired across its bows. The gun crews of Fortress Newcastle practiced, trained, and stood by day after day after day. War seemed a long way away. Like Bombardier, later Captain Stan Newton, there was even time for a bit of fun listening to enemy propaganda on the shortwave radio.
Tokyo Rose was on the radio with her usual babble going on of a night, but on this particular occasion, she signalled Scratchley out, named us, and the old story about suggesting why didn't we lay down our arms and forget all about it, that Japanese boys would be down and wipe us off the hill, as she put it, and it was no use camouflaging the place, that they knew where we were, etc., etc., you know, the usual. So, of course, everybody said, well, rave on. We tended to just dismiss it out of our mind, I'm afraid. Little did we realise that 4 or 5 nights later, we were going to wear it.
June the 8th, 1942. Sometime just after midnight, the 2,500-ton Japanese submarine I-21 surfaced off the coast near Newcastle. The I-21, some 350 feet in length and with a surface speed of 24 knots, was commanded by Captain Hankyu Sasaki, a Japanese naval hero. He had also directed the midget submarine raid on Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December 1941. Now he was in command of what was left of the Sydney Attack Force from the 8th Submarine Squadron. Ashore in Newcastle, gun and searchlight crews had stood down after an earlier air raid alert, a false alarm. Fort Scratchley Battery Commander, Major Wal Watson.
It was a relatively calm night. I had taken one of my rare periods of leave. I'd been out to play chess with a friend, and I arrived home at the fort, or somewhere, I think, between about 11:30 and 12, having been thoroughly trounced at chess, incidentally. And as was a fairly common practice, although I don't claim it as a regular practice, I went round the various points of the battery just to see that all was in order, that the right people were in position and the right equipment was there and so forth, and then I went to bed. But my recollection of the weather and other conditions at that time was it was a very dark night, there was no moon, but it was a relatively still night, there was no weather. There was a slight sea mist. Well, I went to bed, and it was normal for me to fall asleep in 5 or 10 minutes the outside, but about half an hour after I'd been in bed, I realised I was still awake and I couldn't make out why it was. I didn't realise at the moment that there was something that had been worrying me. My mind had gone back to an incident which occurred in the First World War, where a battery commander was, virtually sacked because he had failed to engage a German ship which had stood off and shelled Great Yarmouth. The ship very cunningly positioned itself directly in line with the lighthouse and the guns, and the battery commander, so we understand, didn't fire because he felt in firing that he might endanger the people in the lighthouse. In the subsequent court-martial, however, the court didn't apparently think this was an adequate reason for not engaging, and he therefore was sent elsewhere. I came to realise whilst I was laying awake that this thing had been on my mind for some time and it hadn't crystallised, but it then did immediately crystallise, and I came to recognise that it would be possible for an enemy commander of an enemy vessel, if he knew the location of our various equipment, and we chose to believe that he probably did, that he too could have put himself directly in line between or beyond Nobby's lights and have put us in a position where we too would have had to either take the risk of knocking the light out or doing damage to it by shells passing very close or something like that. Although had he positioned himself at, say, the maximum range of the guns between 7,000 and 8,000 yards, the problem wouldn't have existed because the tragedy would have cleared the lighthouse. Had he have known, and as they probably did, the calibre of the guns and positioned himself at, say, 3,500 to 4,000 yards or thereabouts, then this problem would have existed. And as there were no orders to cover the circumstance, I wrote a little note to myself on a pad and pencil that I kept at the bedside, because I found myself very often waking up in the night and thinking about things, telling myself to ask the fortress commander, Colonel P.W. Dobson, to give me a written instruction as to what I was to do should such a circumstance arise. Having written this little note to myself, I then lay back and thought, well, that's it, that's what's been bugging me, I'll go to sleep now. But for, again, another reason which I have never been able to fathom, I still remained awake. And I suppose I'd been awake for the best part of an hour when I heard the alarm bells in Zara Street Power Station, which I believe is no longer existent, but in those days it was a generating station and it was below the fort. I heard the alarm bells go off down there and wondered what on earth had caused them to go off, and I chose to assume at the moment that somebody had clumsily tripped their switch down then caused their alarms to go off. I of course found out later why it was, and might as well explain it here. The whole of the generating circuit in New South Wales was on a common circuit, and they had a standing order that if any one of the points was attacked at any time, that their alarm was to be tripped, and this notified the others that something had happened. However, I heard this alarm go off and consoled myself with the thought that it was pure accident. And sometime after that, I have never been able to determine how long it was, but I would say it was within 5 minutes, I heard a gunshot, heard gunfire. And as it was then a standing order that no guns could be fired after sunset without the close defence battery commander was advised of it, I was a bit wrathful and promised myself that I'd have somebody's hide the following morning for this.
Out to sea, Captain Sasaki was manoeuvring the I-21 towards the glow of a well-lit Newcastle. His crew manned the 5.5-inch deck gun. From a position in Stockton Bight between 5 and 7,000 yards from Fort Scratchley, the submarine again opened fire.
And then I heard the second round fired and immediately was conscious of the fact that it wasn't one of ours. You learn the sound of your own guns. And I recognised it wasn't one of ours, so I leapt out of bed and pulled on my dressing gown and stepped into my slippers and raced from there up to the command post. And I tripped the alarm switch on my way up. And when I got there, I started asking questions as to what was happening, and I got a whole gabble of answers from various people.
Everywhere in the fort, people were moving and moving fast. Bombardier George Smith.
I was in the gun magazine, in the magazines, I think at the time. Alarm bells went. Upstairs there was quite a fair bit of confusion when we got there. And from memory, all I could see was shells, gun flashes, and a hell of a lot of orders given. We'd been used to alarms over the period of months and months, practice alarms. And naturally we thought this was one of the practice alarms, but it worked out to an action set.
Well, I was on the reserve watch and I was down in the huts outside the outer perimeter of the fort, asleep with the watch in reserve. Now, when the alarms went, they went at approximately 18 minutes past two. And we raced for the inner perimeter of the fort then to get onto the guns and get our ammunition details working. But owing to the garrison battalion being there, they wouldn't let us in until we gave them the password, and half was up over the gates before they opened them. But we eventually got down to the shell store and the cartridge store, and waiting for orders to come through, none came through, and I went up and saw the sergeant in charge of number 2 gun to ask him what it was, and he told me that they thought it was a submarine. Well, I said, in that case, you want armour-piercing shells. He said, yes. Now, this is what we supplied to the gun.
Bombardier Ted Prichter. Major Watson was now at his command post.
Then another round was fired, and which I recognised as star shell because the illumination came up. And I immediately then gave directions to several people in the command post to observe, each being given a particular bearing from A to B, C to D and so forth to observe on. And within a very short space of time, again I can't be sure how much, I got a call from one, I think it was Bombardier Curry if I remember rightly, who gave me advised me that there was a gun flash on a bearing, I think about 065 degrees. I immediately ordered this bearing onto the guns, and the searchlight officer switched the light round onto the appropriate bearing, But because of the limited range of the light, we got no illumination of the target. The target, in my estimation, was possibly about 7,000 yards distant. This is a rather rule of thumb calculation, born of, one's necessary knowledge of the tides at the time and the topography, the seabed topography of Stockton Bight, where the enemy vessel was firing from.
The searchlight at Nobby's was attempting to catch the submarine in its beam. Unfortunately, on that particular day, the 8th of June 1942, the big high current density light at Nobby's was out of action. It had been replaced by a smaller, low current density light.
Well, it only had a 60 million candle power. The carbons in those are so thick. Its range was about a third of what we had from the high current densities. So you could say effective range of that would have only been about 1.5 miles.
Captain Bill Harvey, searchlight commander.
It was brought out by the senior officers of the unit at that time because it needed maintenance and because it needed some repairs. So in emergencies, you've got to make do with what you have.
Unfortunately, on the day preceding this action, it had been necessary to take the high current density lamp normally located at Nobby's out of action because it was long overdue for service, and if left in service very much long, would have probably burnt out altogether and there'd have been no replacement for it. So, however reluctantly, I agreed to the light being taken out to be serviced and being replaced by a low current density lamp. It might be thought, I suppose, that the Japs knew that that particular night was the night to come in. I don't altogether subscribe to that view because actually there would only have been myself and the electric light officer and or perhaps two or three men of his detachment who knew that this change would take place. The responsibility for deciding whether or not to take the light out or to leave it there was entirely mine. I didn't have to advise anybody, I didn't have to get permission for anybody to do it.
Well, it was unfortunate that we weren't able to get it repaired in time to put the other light up there that night. Sometimes these things take longer than just a day. And yes, it was unfortunate.
Out at sea, the I-21's gunners threw star shells over Newcastle to illuminate the city. After the star shells came the 5.5-inch armour-piercing. At Fort Scratchley, Major Watson was using his local knowledge in an attempt to get the submarine's range in the pitch darkness. All that he could see were gun flashes at around 5 to 7,000 yards.
The best I could do was to estimate the range from this knowledge in the belief that he would choose for himself the most suitable position for his firing, bearing in mind that a ship at sea is unlike the steady gun platforms that we have on the coast guns. They're gently rocking about even in a very calm sea, and even force of the gun firing will cause the vessel to move in the water, and they have to realign their range finding and their sighting equipment. So normally in actions between a coast fort and a vessel at sea, the aiming point for the coast artillery weapon is the bow waterline of the target vessel. But since we could not see the vessel, we could only see the gun flash, we had no bow waterline on which to direct the fire. And therefore I gave what is probably the most unorthodox set of gunfire or set of orders that's ever been given in the history of coast artillery. And that was that the autosite layer, which is the man who handles the gun for range, was directed to lay the tip of his sight, or his pointer, on the gun flash, depress the gun an eighth of an inch, by guess and by God, I suppose, and then report when he was on. The layer for line, of course, was more or less automatically laying.
We couldn't see anything in our searchlights. I reported this to the battery commander. But we could see star shells falling all over the place. We couldn't see where it was coming from. Number three light said they saw gun flashes, or what appeared to be gun flashes out at sea. Something in the end of the beam, but they could not really identify what it was. They didn't know.
The pilot vessel Barubi was still on station out in Stockton Bight, very close to the submarine's position. Up on number two gun at Fort Scratchley, they could see the Barubi signalling.
The pilot steamer, he was calling us up with his signalling, and I wanted to know what all the gunfire was about. We couldn't answer him back, it had given our position away. And he made hot-footed for port. As soon as he could, he got out of the road. And when he got out the road, well, we got going.
Bombardier Ted Prichter. On board the Berube, there was also confusion. Seaman Bill Beavis.
I was off watch, and naturally being off watch, I was in my bunk. But I was awakened by, as I thought, a door slamming. And I hear this terrific crash and bang, so I got out of my bunk and up on deck. And the first thing I saw was that the flash to seaward about a mile and a half. And then, of course, this train going past overhead, as I thought, was a peculiar whistling sound. And turning round, I could see the steelworks outline with this terrific, at first it was bluey colour and then it brilliant white like magnesium, I suppose it was, the flares and star shells. But we didn't know what was happening. It could have been anything, a practice or, you know, it was no panic, no scare, because nobody knew what was happening. So they contacted Fort War and were advised to make port, which the Berube in all haste got underway and steamed into port.
The Japanese submarine was firing almost constantly. Captain Bill Harvey on searchlights attempted evasive tactics as the shells came in.
Another one had landed close to number two light, evidently aiming for it, but tactics then were switching the lights was to douse a light with the other one ready to take over from another point. And if you are firing into searchlights and the light goes out, you can't really, it does affect your aim. So this is why I think that some of those shots were not as effective as they may have been, but for that very reason of using lights as tactically as we could to throw them off their ranges.
While Fort Scratchley was moving towards retaliatory action, over on Stockton Peninsula, the detachment at Fort Wallace manned the big 9.2-inch guns.
All we could observe from our observation post were the last two of the gun flashes. It was a very dark night, and Fort Wallace was low-sighted, and there was no means of telling what range the flashes had been observed, whether it was 14 or 24,000 yards out to sea. The battery did have the order to engage on sight, but the searchlight was not strong enough to illuminate any target. The target position or the submarine position ultimately proved to be about 10 to 12,000 yards away from the battery, which was well outside the range of the searchlight. Consequently, Fort Wallace did not at that time engage the submarine.
Colonel Dick Mort. Sergeant, later Warrant Officer Ron Nightingale, was NCO in charge of number one gun at Fort Wallace.
We could sight the see the shot out to sea, the firing and firing towards landward, where the shells were landing. We couldn't tell from our position, but we were all ready to go and go into action and fire. The layers could see the gun flashes and were approximately laying on the points of the gun flashes, and but we were never given the order to fire, and were later told that the fortress commander and fire commander considered that it wasn't necessary for the air battery to take part because of the shortness of the attack. I myself at one point considered whether I should defy all orders and open up, and common sense prevailed, together with the section commander telling me I wasn't doing anything silly.
The lack of action has been criticised, but there was no point in disclosing the position of the battery needlessly, and this is what would have been done by firing at an indeterminate range that would not have done any damage to the submarine.
Colonel Dick Mort. At Fort Scratchley, the guns were ready to fire. Major Watson.
As soon as I got number one on, number two on, I ordered gunfire. The first salvo was on its way, and in accordance with strict Coast Artillery procedure, one automatically ordered a further correction to the guns to increase the range. This is based on the assumption that the first round is fired from a cold gun, and therefore the rate of burning of the charge, the cartridge, will be comparatively slow, and you therefore add something to the original range to put your second round further. Obviously the ideal thing is that the first round should go straight into the target, but we never believe that, we hope but never actually believe that that is what will happen. So therefore your prime objective is to achieve what is known as a bracket, and that is a salvo, two rounds falling minus of the target going from the cold gun, and hopefully the second one's falling plus of the target, in the belief that one's range-finding equipment, which wasn't actually in use in these circumstances, is reasonably accurate.
When we got the order to fire, the first shell that was fired out, a number two gun, which was the first one to open fire, was a practice shell. Now that was always kept in the bore of the gun to stop any boat getting in or out without a clearance. Now that was the first shell that was fired. The second shell that went out, a number two gun, was an armour-piercing shell, the same as what number one gun was fired. Our number two gun fired three, and number one gun fired two. Now this is a bit controversy to what records show. They maintain there's only four shells fired that morning. There were four live rounds, but one practice round went as well, and that was fired by number two gun.
We'd fired our first salvo, and as a matter of courtesy, I'd told the telephonist to inform the fire commander that we were, about what we were doing, and the fire commander immediately sent back, "Engage when you're ready." And the telephonist very dutifully passed this on to me, and my reply was, "Well, tell him we bloody well have." And the second salvo went off immediately after I'd said those words, and the fire commander's words were, "My God, that was fast." The telephonist said, "That, sir, was our second salvo," and hung up the phone on him. Well, the second salvo didn't go off as a perfect salvo, and both guns reported themselves ready, or rather, number one gun reported ready, number two gun reported itself as having a jammed lever breech mechanism. Number one gun was ordered to fire, whilst number two gun cleared the jamming. It was unfortunate that this jamming had occurred, but they were cleared it in fairly short order, and the next round went off. It established at the appropriate elevation, and therefore established the second part of the bracket, or closed the second part of the bracket.
Well, on the third shot, out of number two gun, one of the chaps on the breech, he decided the bucket for the curling of the breech was too far back, and he got it pulled up underneath the breech of the gun. Well, when she went off, it came back and hit that bucket, and bent the hull of the breech mechanism, put the whole thing out of action. So we only had number one gun then was fit for firing.
The shells from submarine I-21 were landing all over the Newcastle city and port area, alerting off-duty members of the battery. Stan Newton was one of those off-duty soldiers now heading for the fort.
That time of the night, no public transport around, so I was fortunate enough to grab a cab and go to the cabbie destination and headed off up towards the fort. By the time we'd got there, round about the railway station, Newcastle, we could hear firing taking place. Cabby was rather a shy type of fellow as far as gunfire was concerned, and took me as far as Telford Street and called it off and said, "You're on your own from here, mate." Come to think of it, he never did even charge me for the ride. All he wanted was out. And I left the cab there and then ran up Scott Street for the rest of the way until I approached the corner of Parnell Place, and the shell at this stage of the game were landing over in Parnell Place, but not exploding. But I went to earth around the corner in case they changed their mind. But when things died down a bit, I decided to make a run for it. And I think that was my folly. And by this time, the sub-commander undoubtedly realised he'd gone too far south with his fall of shot and corrected. And I picked a wrong moment to run. It was the one that landed in Parnell Place. I landed on the crown of the road, a great shower of sparks, and brought down the high tension wires, which in those days used to run from Zara Street Powerhouse, brought those down. And in amongst all this great display of fireworks with the high tension cables, and just momentarily I had time to see the thing starting to roll towards George Lowe's shop. Thank heavens it didn't go off immediately, or it might have been a different story. But that gave me the breathing space to retrace my steps a bit and get out of the way. I guess I think uppermost thought was to get back to your post on duty, and I headed just straight through up into the fort. And fortunately, the guards on duty recognised me and let me through. But, it wasn't until it was all over that even then I didn't realise it. I think I must have been a bit numb or something like this from this business, and somebody else noticed that I was bleeding pretty badly. And, in the heat of the business, I just don't think I realised it at the time. Piece of shrapnel just lodged in near the right eye, in between the eye and the nose in that section.
Mr. and Mrs. Peter Lowe lived about the shop in Parnell Place.
I heard the whistling going over, like shells going over, and quite a few, and I got up and went out to have a look, went out on the veranda, and I could see people going to the air raid shelter, and I come in and said to the wife, I said, there's something doing, I don't know what it is, but the lights are still on, they can't be much. And a few minutes afterwards, bang, come the shell and right in front of the door. Well, right out, just out in the middle of the road. And luckily we had the glass taken out of the window, the shop window, and masonite was put in. But they were blown right out. And a lot of tins of biscuits, piece of the shell went through, about half a dozen tins, and there was biscuits everywhere.
Next door to the Lowes lived the Wilsons.
Oh, I blew out the windows and doors and the wiring into the house, on the front of the house, the electricity. Because when the blackout was over, we didn't have any lights anyway because the wires were all down. People were milling around, you know, just... That's the silly part of it. All people came into Parnell Place and were milling around when the wires were all hanging in the street, live wires. It was worse than the bombing, really. It only left a big hole in the street that you could stand down in the hole. That's all. It didn't, and I chopped up a few big shrubs and that out of the park. I think there was some landed in the garden over there, and quite a few behind the Travelodge Motel. The army took those away the next day.
Mrs. Phyllis Wilson. Her son Peter was just 9 years of age at the time.
I remember Mum coming up and opening back the sliding windows, and it was just like daylight outside. There was plenty of bang, bang, bang going on, but I don't know whether that was our guns or it was the Japanese submarine or what. But Mum said, I think they're only practicing, but just to make sure we'll get out of here. And we did this. We got to the top of the stairs. I think it was the top of the stairs. And just then there was one almighty bang. And all glass, the smell of cordite right through the house. Then there was just one mad scramble outside. There seemed to be people running around everywhere, blowing whistles and air raid waters, telling people to get back inside because everybody wanted to get out and see just what was going on. Then after that, I'd say a couple of hours after that, when things settled down a little bit, people just seemed to wander in and out of the place with pliers and whatever they could find just to get take a few souvenirs. They just wandered through the place most of the morning. Until I think the police did step in a little bit too. I think they did come up and more or less take control of things. There was a reporter came up and he was interviewing Mum, and we were out in the veranda where I slept, and there was a hole about three or four inches in diameter, And he said, I wonder how this got onto the wall without going through the bed. So, of course, the bed was covered with glass and pieces of old window sash, etc. And he pulled back the mattress and the bed was completely cut in half by this big lump of shrapnel, which we found underneath the bed. It must have hit the wall and dropped straight onto the floor. It was a piece about 3 inches or so. But it really cut the place in half, or the bed in half at least.
A lucky escape for Peter Wilson in Parnell Place. While Stan Newton, with a piece of shrapnel in his forehead, was pressing on to Fort Scratchley, across town, another soldier made plans to return to his post at the fort.
Yeah, I was home in bed. I heard the shells coming over, and on going out to the veranda to have a look, the father-in-law was there, and he said, I'm glad, I explained this, when a ship passed the line or came across the line, we'd put a shot across its bows, and he said, I suppose some ships run the line. And I said, be buggered, they're coming back in. I realised then that I was AWL. And I had to run over that high-level bridge at Islington all the way up that... I continued on from there down to the bank corner, and at Young and Green's I could call in and get a taxi. And when I got there, the bloke said, where are you going? And I said, Scratchley. He said, not with me, you're not. And just then the lights went out in the streets, and he said, that's my cue. I've got to pull in to the gutter and turn my lights off and stop there. So he said, why don't you go down to the West End police station? And they'll run you in. And I said, yes, that's what I'm frightened of. And he didn't know that the West End police station was occupied by the Provo. So I gave them a wide berth, and I continued on up to Scratchley, running sometimes, walking others, and every time that I'd think of the consequences of deserting in the face of the enemy fire, I'd have to run again. So I just came around the corner of Parnell Place, and where a shell had landed, and there was a large depression in the roadway, and it had done considerable damage. So I wandered up to the fort. From there on, I couldn't run, and I had to stroll leisurely and walk straight in. And to my amazement, nothing was said at all.
Apart from the shell which exploded in Parnell Place, it's difficult to gauge the exact number of shots fired by the I-21 from Stockton Bight. The official war history states that 24 shells were fired, but opinions do differ.
Another round landed on the seawall, down close to the bars, and that one did explode. It knocked several pieces of the stonework out of the seawall. Another round went through the knuckle, which is a point on the wharfing of the river, down the vicinity of the railway yards. That round is believed to have exploded because it punched its way through the planking on the wharf, and Navy divers went down subsequently and couldn't find it, and therefore that one is believed to have shattered under the water, or exploded under the water after going through the planking. And two others landed in what was then known as the turntable, which was a round piece of land around which the trams came up Scott Street, circled or semi-circled round this piece of land and turned to go down Hunter Street, and they landed in this blank and unused piece of land and were subsequently dug out the following day. That I think makes a total of 8 effective rounds that were fired, not counting the star shell. of which I believe there were three or possibly no more than four.
I reckon there was at least 28 of them came over. The first one landed fair in the middle of the steelwork of the administrative block. And the last one was the one that exploded on the roadway in Zara Street and peppered the house there. And that was the one that injured Stan Newton when he was on his way back from leave, as he came round the corner from Scott Street.
After the war, I returned to BHP, where I was working on, at the coke ovens, and was informed by men who were on duty the night of the Jap raid that the shells, several shells, had straddled fairly vital targets, the blast furnace, the benzol plant, and I understood one had landed in the grounds of one of the subsidiary administrative officers.
Unfortunately, when they stopped firing, we, since the light wouldn't illuminate the target, we had no means of firing or continuing firing, much as I would like to have continued, but we didn't know whether they were simply reversing straight out and we would fire on a line which we could calculate, or whether they would, as they most probably would have done, would have zigzagged out to have confused us, and therefore, unfortunately, we didn't get another shot at it, which from our point of view is a matter of great regret.
The Japanese submarine had ceased firing between 5 and 10 minutes after the initial engagement. It seems that she could have stayed on the surface longer, but that the shells from Fort Scratchley were inching closer. Major Wal Watson.
Examination officer, Jack Burgess, Lieutenant Commander Jack Burgess, came the next day up to the fort and told me that the rounds, the salvos we'd fired, went clean over the Berube. Incidentally, after the first salvo had been fired and went over them, the ship's master actually ordered steam up, and they steamed for the safety of the port, very sensibly. And he told me that we had scored a bracket. We couldn't see it because of the poor illumination and the distance that the enemy vessel, the submarine, was from us, but they were probably 3,000 yards closer to it than we were, and were down on the water level, or virtually on the water level, as was the vessel, and therefore had a better chance of seeing the fall of shot than we had, being up in an elevated position and looking down on a light which wasn't much use to us anyhow. But we have his assurance, and others who are on duty with him, that the first salvo landed minus. This can be told, of course, because when the shots hit the water, they throw up great white pillars of water. And the second landed a plus, which is over the target, which is confirmation of the assumption we made when the vessel stopped firing, that we had got him within a bracket.
At Fort Scratchley, the excitement of the battle lingered well into the early hours of the morning, long after the submarine had gone.
Yeah, we were in high glee, so we were on our toes and waiting for something else to happen. And we'd have been right if it had, because we knew what we were in for. But it gives you a funny feeling to hear those shells whittling over you. And the one you hear is the one you haven't got to worry about, they tell us, and that's quite right, because it's gone.
Yes, there was an air of excitement. I don't think I'd like to hear my own voice giving the original order to fire. I think I probably screamed, because although we had proper loudspeaker communication between the command post and the guns, I probably felt that even that mightn't work, therefore I yelled at the top of my voice to make sure they heard it. They would have been within a voice range, of course. Although if there'd been a high wind rain, it would have been howling with rain or something other like that, they might have had some trouble hearing it. But I'm pretty sure I literally screamed the original order to fire. I believe the ranging orders given, being so unorthodox, were given in a relatively normal tone of voice, but I think the order to fire was literally given at a top scream. I at least was excited. I'm pretty sure others were too, but I frankly admit that I was madly excited, because it so happens that this is the only time in the history of coast forts in Australia that one has ever fired a shot in anger. Other shots have been fired by coast batteries in the course of war, but they were what we call warning shots to vessels which had either ignored or disobeyed a signal given to them, and as was standard practice, a shot, not an explosive shot, just a what we call a practice round, just a great shaped lump of steel, was fired across their bows to say, well, watch it or the next one will be at you. There were a few of those fired, but this was the first time and only time that a shot has ever been fired from a coast battery in Australia, a shot has ever been fired in anger from a coast battery in Australia.
I think unless you lived right up around the top end of Newcastle in Parnell Place, Zara Street, something in that area, You wouldn't have even known that it was on. It's amazing the number of people in Newcastle who knew nothing about it until they either heard it on the radio or read it in the paper the next morning. And that includes my own wife, who wasn't my wife at the time. We were engaged, but she only knew about it after she heard it on the radio the next morning. And she lived in one of the inner suburbs. She wasn't that far out. there's most of the civilian population, were unaware or just ignored it and probably thought we were having a shooter or something like this.
Well, up until then, it had been a big joke, the war. My kids up there at Parnell Place, we were used to the guns going off and that, practicing, and we'd always get up the end of Beach Street there and go and watch them practice. And it had been one big thrill, but when that thing went off, I thought, this is not as funny as it used to be. It frightened me, as a matter of fact.
Oh, even today, if I come in contact with people and it comes up in conversation, they say, oh, that was a stunt by the government just to help fill the wall up, which is really funny, I think. Yeah, unbelievable, really.
A footnote. Japanese naval intelligence records that 34 shots were fired at Newcastle by the I-21, 26 conventional explosive charges, and 8 star shells. The engagement commenced at 2:14 a.m. and ended at 2:30, and the submarine commander noted in his log that counterfiring from Fort Scratchley ceased at 2:27. The submarine commander had as his targets the iron and steel works, shipyards, airfield, and the two forts. It's possible that the airfield in question was the small one located on Walsh Island. The operation of this strip was, however, discontinued well before the war. After the attack on the 8th of June, the I-21 headed to sea and returned to its base in the Marshall Islands, where it arrived 2.5 weeks later on the 25th of June, 1942. Captain Hankyu Sasaki, commander of the I-21 during the attack on Newcastle, survived the war and died only a year or two ago in Tokyo. Allied naval intelligence shows that the I-21 was depth-charged and sunk by the destroyer USS Charette on the 4th of February 1944. She went to the bottom at position 6 degrees 48 minutes north, 168 degrees 8 minutes east, near the Gilbert Islands. The I-21's crew of some 80 men went down with her.
That was War on the Doorstep, an eyewitness account of Japanese naval action on the New South Wales coast in World War II. The programme was compiled and produced by Martin Hadlow in the studios of 2NURFM,